Gabby and Mandy are going to present the Happy Museum project. Gabby Porter is associate in the Happy Museum project, giving support to the communities. Now you can see me. Okay, so as I said, we work for the Happy Museum to do project, give support to the community and the managers of the museum. And she was the president of the board of the Happy Museum. And Gabby also worked during many years as a curator in British museums, local independent museums. And now she's an independent facilitator coach in different cultural environments, museum studies and facilitator. And Mandy Barnett has 35 years of experience in the nonprofit organizations with the inclusion of vulnerable communities in cultural projects. She is a professional in measuring the social impact and responsible of the Social Value UK network. Whenever you want, Gabby and Mandy, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting us to speak. So I'm going to just give a short background and talk about the kind of vision and approach of Happy Museum, and then Mandy is going to talk more about the evaluation. So we stimulate and support museum practice that focuses on the well-being of people, place and planet. And we invite museums to think about their role as citizens in the present and stewards of the future as well as the past. So we are very much offering that provocation and invitation to join this sense of, you know, the well-being for the future generations. So Happy Museum is not an organization, it's not a museum, it's a network and a community. And constitutionally and financially, we are now hosted by Julie's Bicycle, which is a charity working around climate justice and social justice in the cultural arena. So we know that we are at a time of many multiple crises, and this diagram from Future Earth shows us the range and complex interconnectedness of risks, which together have the potential to lead to global systemic crisis. And this challenges any notion of business as usual, or indeed of normal life. And yet, from our perspective, very few museums are addressing this directly and with the urgency needed. So as Pirjo said, you know, people struggle to make the time to consider these larger issues, to look beyond the everyday tasks and to look up from their keyboards, to think about the larger environment that we are in and the risks. So the Happy Museum has always sought to challenge a dominant model of economic growth and to live within our limits. We seek to live within our planetary limits and within our personal limits. So that lovely phrase from Jason Hickel of kind of private sufficiency and public wealth. And we draw on many other fields of inquiry and frames for understanding, particularly those which challenge the conventional narratives of individualism, material consumption, resource depletion, wealth accumulation, and massive inequality. So what does this mean for museums? So in 2010, Tony Butler, who founded Happy Museum, was working as director of the Museum of East Anglian Life. And that was redefining its purpose as a social enterprise, because he felt the strength lay not just in the collections and the historic buildings, but in the social networks that were created and forming between visitors, volunteers, and people working there. So the museum was a springboard for participants in the museum's programs. Not only did they benefit from the programs taking part in those programs, but in addition, they formed relationships, new friendships, ran into each other outside the museum in the local shops and high street, and supported each other in times of personal difficulty. So people who previously had isolated lives now had newfound confidence to socialize. They had purpose. They became more adaptable and more resilient. So Tony proposed that a focus on societal well-being, on what truly makes communities thrive, both now and for the future, might provide a challenge to dominant paradigms around economic growth and overconsumption, and that in this frame, museums offer a great deal. So Happy Museum has been through many iterations, I suppose, of its existence. And it kind of has grown as an active community, as an action learning project, shaping and testing a vision for well-being in different settings, according to different communities, collections, contexts. And we're determinedly non-hierarchical and interdisciplinary, and we often work with diagonal slice teams of people in different levels and different functional areas within museums or beyond museums with volunteers and trustees. So initially in the upper layers of this slide, we worked with, we commissioned museums to experiment with sustainable well-being and to bring in experts from outside the sector to make the links between our fragile planet and community well-being, and a particular opportunity and role for museums in that. So we had 22 creative interventions at this time. And then in the middle layer of this slide, from 2015, with funding from the Arts Council England, Happy Museum embarked on a longitudinal study with a small cohort of 6 museums to explore what the longer term impacts might be of working in this way. And each of these participants also commissioned and developed specific projects that they worked with. So for instance, Manchester Museum worked on the Playful Museum, and Derby Museums worked on human-centered design. And then from about 2017, we developed an affiliate network of museums, a kind of light touch network, inviting people to work with the principles of the Happy Museum and to use them for their own purposes and to make them their own. So we have a very wide community of practice, including city, regional, national museums, tourist attractions, open air museums and galleries, arts, digital, heritage organizations, a theater and a zoo. And our more recent project in 2020 was an online peer learning program called No Going Back, where we sought to take the opportunity of the pause, if you like, of the pandemic, to ask museums to think about this as an opportunity to reframe and reset, to think afresh about their purpose and their future at a time of such massive change and turbulence, and a greater focus here on the environmental crisis and the challenge to biodiversity. So as common sense tells us, there are many things that we need to do to combat climate change and biodiversity loss and to reduce our impact on the planet. But these also have really positive benefits on our health and well-being, on our communities and our neighborhoods. And at Happy Museum, we seek to work upstream, so helping communities to thrive and be healthy in the very widest sense, so that we can avoid the need to repair, rescue, and recover for both people and planet. And at the heart of Happy Museum was this very early paper of 2012 with a manifesto and a vision for Happy Museums. And out of the museums undertaking the commissions and regularly coming together to share their experience and to share their learning, there was a development of these principles which guide us in the way that we work. So I'm going to hand on to Mandy now to take us forward from this point. Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Gabby. Hello, everyone. So I have been the evaluator and learning evaluator for Happy Museum for several years. And we took the approach that I would be embedded in the project. So it was never a hand, an arm's length, stand back, observe kind of evaluation. It was always a get stuck in, understand, change things as we go along kind of evaluation. And so there are three things that I would like to talk to you briefly about now. There's a lot more we could say. But the first is the importance of all of that pre-work and planning to how Happy Museums work. So all that work on the manifesto, principles and a vision and so on is a really important part of our evaluation. And then I want to talk to you about two different types of evidence that we look at, evidence at the national level and evidence at the local level, which have very different purposes and we approach in a different way. So I want to talk about those three things all the time, thinking about us as using culture to affect wider social outcomes. So that's what we're interested in, those broad social outcomes. So I do a lot of work now in measuring and helping manage value from cultural organisations in terms of social impact. I'm also chair of Social Value UK, which is a broad organisation that does that in this country. So next slide, Gabby. So the key thing to say here is that we allow museums to create their own stories as part of our programme. We don't try and shape things from the top down. So whilst we share a manifesto and share a vision, we know that it's really important to museums to develop their stories bottom up, partly because they will be able to meet their local needs more accurately, more specifically by doing that. And partly because that's what empowers people. From the point of view of using evaluation to form your work, it's much more engaging to be developing that yourself than to have it delivered to you. So we use this approach that we call the story of change. Very simple. All we do is ask people to start at the end point and work back when they're planning. So we ask them why they are doing what they are doing. And we slightly rudely use the question, so what? So that, because often people will talk about what they're doing, not why they're doing it. So we use that so what question to keep pushing why? What's the real difference that you want to make for you and for other people? And there's quite a nice TED talk by Simon Sinek on that, on starting with why in the corporate sector is worth a look. So we start by asking about the why in this story, and then we work back through, okay, who does that mean we need to involve? What do we need to do? And how do we need to do it? And often how we do it, the principles, is as important as what we do. So that's the central to everything we do is the story of change and allowing museums to make local solutions, which we then fit together into the Happy Museum program to learn collectively from them. So next slide, Gabby. So this is what we developed from the first round of Happy Museums, which is a combination of all of their work on different stories of change, pulling out the common themes. So it's a bit small to read, but down the left are those principles that Gabby just showed you about measuring what matters, as distinct from what we can easily measure, being an active citizen, pursuing mutual relationships, creating conditions for well-being, learning for resilience, and valuing the environment, and being a steward of the future as well as the past, as museums are more traditionally. So museums came up with a variety of ways they were going to use those principles to create some really big outcomes. So on the right, we have these visionary outcomes, which include rethinking what matters. So what really matters to people, you know, not just what earns us money, to create happy, resilient people, and to create happy, resilient teams. And it's often very important for cultural organisations to think about their own workforce, because we're all under a lot of pressure. And then the bottom right box is what we learned that actually pretty consistently museums can do for local communities. And it boils down to four sort of key areas or outcome domains: learning and contribution to the economy, interacting and relationships, feeling happy, satisfied and worthwhile, and being environmentally aware. And we shape those words so that they created a really nice acronym for us, which is LIFE. So if you could go on to the next slide, Gabby. So we are trying to all the time think more widely than we often do about our cultural life. And that fits with the what we call the three P's: people, prosperity, and planet. But those three big domains of social impact, so social, economic, and environmental benefit. And happy museums, and probably all museums, contribute to all of those things. And what they are particularly good at is helping people have their own relationships with those things. So relating to other people by interacting with them, having a relationship with their own prosperity or their neighbourhood's prosperity by learning together, and thinking about protecting the environment by really focusing on environmental awareness. So next slide, Gabby. So here are pictures from four of our projects that from which we kind of derive this learning. So the top left one is at Canterbury Museums, and it was called the Paper Apothecary. Apothecary is a pharmacist. So the artist went into the museum and created a beautiful, made out of recycled paper, chemist building. Community groups worked with the museum to identify things in the museum that really enhanced well-being, that really made people happy. And then these actors gave people prescriptions, well-being prescriptions, as they came into the museum and they went away and did the thing. So you can see from that picture, really interactive, really fun, really engaging exhibit. The one below that is London Transport Museum, who partnered with a homeless charity in London, and they trained homeless people to come in and be volunteers in the museum. So they were learning real tangible skills, actually getting on a bit of a career path as well. The bottom right picture is from a small country museum, Godalming Museum, which is one of the first places, or I think might have been the first place in England to have a water mill. So it's got this sort of industrial stroke environmental heritage, which is really important. And they created a new environmental gallery that explored that and the history up to the present day crafts and so on that they included there. And then the middle picture, in the middle of all this sits feelings. And a lot of our projects were really focused on making things fun and playful and aesthetic and creative. And that picture is from the Story Museum in Oxford. And it's not, you know, no big deal. It's not a big exhibit. It's just the sorts of fun things that you will find there to kind of make your mood better as you go through the museum. So next slide, Gammy. So that's all about feelings, and well-being is at the heart of everything we do. But well-being isn't just about feelings, it's also about functioning. So this quote sums up what we think museums do really well. So the future is not some place we are going to, but one we are creating. The paths are not to be found, but made. And the activity of making them changes both the maker and the destination. So in Happy Museum, we believe really strongly that museums are very good at creating agency or empowerment, enabling people to make a difference to their own lives and in their own communities. And that's central to everything that we do. So next slide, please, Gabby. So building on that, I'm moving on to my second point now, which is about the national evidence that we look at. We wanted to create some consistent evaluation questions that helped us learn about both feelings and functioning in the widest sense of well-being. So along the top there, it says learning, interaction, feelings and environment. So those are our four domains of broad cultural well-being. And down the left-hand side, we've got those three sets of questions. So short-term feelings, longer-term feelings and functioning. So these questions all come from national surveys where we know there are national data sets so that we can compare with the national population. And that's really helpful to us, I guess, for two reasons. One is it helps us to tell that bigger story. So we can start to talk about actually really, you know, all museums being good at this, or, you know, a huge number of museums being good at this. But it also allows us to compare within our projects and across museums. So one of the very interesting pieces of work that a partner of ours did a few years ago, Daniel Fujiwara, who is a happiness economist, looked at the well-being value from small and large museums using GPS tracking. And they found out that there was really high well-being created from small museums, higher than the large museums, using these questions about feelings that are in that green column there. So those questions come from our Office of National Statistics. They're well-being questions that were actually developed and we contributed to as part of Happy Museum a few years ago. And they ask about how happy you are, how satisfied with life, and how worthwhile you feel. So those are really important questions for us. If you go on to the next slide, Gabby, I can just show you a little example of how we've used those. So this was a comparison of three projects, actually not in museums. This was in the broader participatory arts sector. We ran three projects and we used those ONS, Wellbeing Questions, Office of National Statistics. So one of the projects was work was a creative project in a library that specifically was attracting vulnerable people. So there were homeless people, people with long-term disabilities and so on. That's the top one. The second project was a creative project, excuse me, in a workplace. So working with employees over a period of time. And the third project was with villagers and it was based on their village green. It was a little pop-up thing that appeared every so often for them to interact with. And the circles in the middle show the population average for the wellbeing question, which is 7.5 out of 10. The two top projects started the project lower than the national average. The bottom one, villagers on their village green, started above the local average. They all shifted in the time of the project to above the local average, you know, and some quite significantly so. So this, we gather this information from asking participants about their wellbeing before and after the project. And that's really crucial for two reasons. One is we know that people are very likely to bias their answers if they reflect afterwards. They're very likely to exaggerate the impact or to say things to please you. So we have to ask the before and after questions for that reason. But the second is that it really allows us to plan what we're doing as a result of this learning. So all of our formative evaluation is about actually influencing things while there's still time to make a difference. So you can see that You can guess why those two groups at the top left might have had a low well-being. One was a group of vulnerable people, the other was people in the workplace where, you know, they maybe weren't as happy as they might be in other places in their life. So that approach is vital to us, that really careful planning, so that we can robustly evidence, but also so that we can always affect what we do, because we only evaluate in order to improve. So next slide, Gabby. So that is a look at how we use national questions about life, learning, interactions, feelings, environment from the Office of National Statistics and other surveys to capture that big picture and to be able to compare. Next slide. But the other thing that we do that is really important and possibly even more important for our Happy Museum way of working is that we use local approaches, which are often co-created. So we often devise the evaluation approach with the participants themselves. And there are, again, two reasons why that works really well. One is because people feel involved. And, you know, one of the biggest problems we have in evaluation is getting practitioners or frontline people to gather evidence. Well, if they're involved in creating the evidence approaches, they're much more likely to do it. And the other is it allows us to be more specific to meet local needs and so on. So this is our second kind of big approach, is these locally created approaches. So now I'm just going to talk you through three examples of those. So this is from that paper apothecary project at Canterbury Museums. The participants were handed a prescription on a piece of paper. At the bottom, so they told them to go away and do something in the museum, like roar at the lion or meet one of the particularly friendly attendants. And then at the bottom of their prescription was a tear-off strip which asked them how they were feeling as a result of their treatment. And so, and they put it in this beautifully created feedback box at the exit to the museum. We've gathered the evidence straight away. It's part of the activity. It's embedded. It's fun. People don't even notice, you know, that they're giving you data, as it were. So that's the paper apothecary. The next one, this was an approach from Reading Museum, which is a sort of fairly large city town, not far outside London. So they worked with their neighbourhood action groups on seeing how the museum could work in neighbourhoods to improve the local, help citizens improve the local area. They asked people to select from these words that were on word cards at the beginning of the project. They then sealed those words up in what we called a time capsule, just creating a bit of theatre, a bit of fun, and then put those aside, did the exercise again at the end of the project, and then opened the time capsule to see how they compare. So we saw that there was a noticeable increase in the number of positive words at the end of the project. But again, that's a, you know, nice engaging thing to do. It doesn't feel like it's evaluation, just feels like it's part of the exercise. And we call that time capsule. And then the final one is back to the Story Museum, who had the little teapot with the eyes on it. So the Story Museum create this, what they call a mood tree, just very simple. So at the audience, as they come into the exhibition, choose a red, amber or green leaf to put on the tree that reflects their mood. And then at the end of the exhibition, they do it again to see if their mood has changed. So really simple, light touch, fun, pretty, aesthetic, you know, aesthetically pleasing. So those are three examples of the sort of interactive things that we devise through Happy Museum and that we use, we go on to use all over the place. And there's the link there. There are, you know, various other tools that we devise that might be worth you having a look at. So to wrap that up, really, this is a quote from our UK Centre for Cultural Value, and it really does sum up what Happy Museum's approach to evaluation is. So it says, evaluation is too often seen as serving the needs of funders rather than organisations, or most importantly, users and the wider public. And that's what we're addressing, those three different groups with our approach to evaluation. So we do need to serve the needs of funders and investors. You know, we need to make the case for culture all the time, especially nationally. So we're doing that. But we are also serving the organisation by making sure that they can really learn from the evaluation in a timely fashion, in time to do something about it. And we are serving the public and the participants, because we are doing an evaluation that helps them to think about their own changes, that's empowering for them. So very different from that sort of national approach, but equally important for us. So I just want to finish by telling you where we're up to now, which is that, so we've been developing these approaches for 12 years now, and we go on to use them and test them and develop them further in all different cultural settings. So at the moment, we are working with Suffolk County Council and with Suffolk Museums, using some of the learning. We are turning those life questions, so those four questions, three sets of questions, into an app. So the really nice thing about that is that we can they can use that in a really light touch way with audiences, for example, in festivals, which is always very hard to get evidence about, could work really nicely with visitors in museums as well. But we're also thinking more deeply again about how culture really supports behaviour change for some of the big challenges that Gabby talked about at the beginning. And we're working closely with the Public Health Data Observatory there, and also with economics colleagues at the County Council. And a particularly important part of that is bringing the human story in more strongly into the environment story, because, you know, it's really clear that the message about the environment is still not hitting home. And my view is that that's because we talk all the time about the science, parts per million, degrees centigrade, and people don't get the human story. So that's a really important part of what we're doing now. So next slide, Gabby. So we're creating this evaluation framework for them for their cultural health and wellbeing programme. And if you look at the next slide, Gabby, and we're introducing into their thinking the idea of this, what we call the emotional curve. So the ups and downs of the emotional journey that people have to go through in order to change. So the model is called Suffolk Can. So it has a positive feel to it. Suffolk can do things, we can make things better. And that's about combining culture with assets to meet needs and change lives. So the elements that culture and museums are particularly good at, starting at the bottom left, are we are uniquely placed to reach different people. We're, you know, libraries, museums, really good at reaching into the communities. We can help people to access what we call an asset-based approach, a positive approach. So not just cultural assets, but also their own personal assets, and build their agency. We can address needs, their needs, by co-creating projects together. So people choose their journeys and outcomes when they engage with us. We create supportive and enjoyable environments that are focused, because we did that planning right at the beginning, on really making a difference. And of course, we're there for the long term. We're available to everyone. We're often free, and we're there connecting people. So that's where we're taking this now, building on our Happy Museum learning about how we affect behaviour. So final slide just shares some resources with you. So there's the Happy Museum link. We also, after we worked with Happy Museum for some time, created this resource, which we call Culture Cubed. So the idea that culture is cubed by affecting social, economic and environmental benefits, or those three P's. I, as I said, as part of Social Value UK, which is part of Social Value International, global network of social value professionals, which you might find interesting to look at. And one of their members is España Impact. So there's a local connection for you there. So, and finally, there's Hilary, who's the director of museums, Gabby, who you've just met, and my contact details there. I'm very happy for you to get in touch. So thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Moltes gràcies a vosaltres.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Gabby. Thank you, Mandy.
We have some questions. Andrea is asking Mandy. Can you please give us your conceptualization of the co-creation concept you have presented? Which are the main goals with this method? At what level in the production chain? And one last thing, do you evaluate the co-creation?
So co-creation is all the rage in the UK, isn't it, Gabby?
Yeah.
So normally people talk about co-creation in terms of making a project together or co-creating a museum together. So Tony Bartlett, who created Happy Museum, has co-created a new museum of making in Derby, a huge museum with the community, and they have been involved all the way in terms of deciding what the exhibits are, deciding what the messages are, creating the physical space and so on. From our point of view, we try and mirror that by co-creating the evaluation approach. So the goals of that, so it's about creating a method that works for people. Actually, I'm going to answer the question about what level. It's all the nearer we can get to the beneficiaries, the people who we want to have the social impact, the better. But often we might work with the frontline practitioners, and sometimes we're working with managers in museums. So we're always trying to get as close as we possibly can to the people that we want to learn about in order to create an evaluation that works for them. So that's the sort of answer about the production chain. The goals of that are to empower people to not do things to people, but to do things with people, but also to be realistic. So to create, there's no point in creating a 30 question long questionnaire, you know, that asks all the perfect questions you want to ask, but no one will complete it because they're bored by a questionnaire, or maybe they don't write very good English. So it's about creating, using the right language and using the right methods that works for the people that we are talking with. So, you know, we do this right at the beginning when we decide what an evaluation is for. So if it's for health colleagues, for example, we want to ask about health questions, we want to ask about health, but in a way, in a language that those people recognize. What was the last bit? Co-creation. I think it was just a definition of co-creation, wasn't it? Go ahead.
I'd like to add a little bit as well, which is there's a fundamental issue about respect and equality, that we want to involve people in helping to make decisions if they're going to be affected by the outcome of those decisions. And that's what cultural institutions, you know, they're all about, engaging people, and therefore we need to offer that kind of respect and opportunity for people to contribute. And also we know that the earlier that we bring people into processes and invite them to help to kind of shape and consider those processes, and where possible, if we can make it experiential rather than just informatic, if you like, we know that that's going to create a much more powerful and longer term impact on the people that are involved. Sorry to interrupt, Mandy.
Finished.
Okay. Em sembla que també preguntava al final per l'avaluació de la co-creació.
There was also a question about the assessment of the co-creation. Is the assessment a part of, sorry, co-creation is a part of your assessment?
Do you mean, do we assess the co-creation approach in evaluation? I suppose, well, it's interesting, actually. We've just been evaluating.
Hemos estado.
Sorry, did I get that wrong?
Sorry.
we've just been evaluating our city of culture in the UK, which has been in Coventry, and they have really wanted us to look at the value of co-creation. And we've done some comparative studies and noticed that there has been a 4 times higher return on investment for the projects that were co-created than the ones that were bought actually off the shelf. So we're not there yet, though. It's very hard, because it's so hard to know what the counterfactual is. So what would have happened anyway? It's very hard to compare a co-created project with one that isn't co-created. Most of it is qualitative, and you know, it's about just getting feedback from people about how it feels. But we anecdotally, we know it's better, we can see it's better. I don't know how robustly we can evidence that yet.
Okay. Because it's also generative, in that we learn through each version of the evaluation. We learn both about the evaluation methodology as well as what it is that we need to plan and change in our planning. So it has a kind of iterative cycle. Yeah.
Okay. Y una otra pregunta.
There's one more question by Anthony Laporte. He's asking, do you think that the questions of the life model can be applied to different European countries, such as Spain, or do we need to define new questions for every cultural environment?
Sadly, I think the second, because what, two things to say here. One is, what we are trying to do is compare with how we know our national population is performing. And so if those questions are not asked systematically in Spain, you've got no comparator. So you lose that benefit. And some of the surveys that we're using have been going for 20 or 30 years. So, you know, they really do provide very long-term good evidence. So things like Understanding Society and Community Life Survey in Britain. I mean, there are European-wide surveys that are used, but I don't very often look at those, because often the data is not at a granular enough level. So it's done, those surveys are done to compare nations, and we want to compare much, much smaller areas. But the other thing to say is that those Office of National Statistics questions, there are 4 well-being questions, which are broad, basically, how happy are you, how satisfied with your life, how worthwhile do you feel, and how anxious are you? And actually, they're a really, really good set of questions. You know, they really do encompass everything we need to know about well-being. So those in themselves are good questions, but actually they wouldn't give you the benefit of that national comparator that I think is really worth having.
Okay, thank you. Antoni
is also commenting or asking if you could present more techniques, those you include under the Tools for Personal Outcomes title.
So a couple of examples spring to mind. One is the use of observation. So, I mean, that might not sound very clever, but actually it's a really helpful tool, particularly when you're working with some sorts of participants, but also in some environments. And it's important to do it systematically. So we have developed an approach with a psychologist where we looked at how you observe a certain period of time systematically, how you do that with more than one person so that you validate the learning, how you count, how you collect quotes and so on. So I think that's a really important part of our person-centered approach. The other one that I wanted to mention, I'm not sure if this is what you mean or not, but we use the transformation cycle for museums to assess their own performance. And whilst that's not about participants, it's really important, a reflection for teams. So they look at where they are on a journey. It's a bit like that emotional curve that I was showing you. You know, are they beginning? Are they at the stage where they don't know what they don't know? Have they started to learn they need to change and they're not very good yet? have they actually made some good changes that are starting to go into, you know, be regularly used? And then finally, is the change really embedded in the organisation? Because it's not until you get to that business as usual point where it's an unconscious thing, you know, you just do things a different way, that the value really gets secured. And that same tool, we use that in museums, in Happy Museum, but the same tool actually works really well with individuals. It's what they use for things like treating addiction, you know, the idea that you need to really embed things, and that if you don't, outcomes slip back and you lose the value. And we see that all the time. So that's a couple of examples.
Molt bé. Vicente Simón.
Vicente Simón is asking if you could provide more examples on how you assess the feelings of a person before and after visiting a museum. What feelings do you use to do the evaluation?
Yeah. I think there are a couple of things that I would say there. We haven't yet cracked assessing the feelings of people who don't come to museums. We don't have the resources to work on that. That's a huge task. One of the things that we do that works really well is when we're working with participants, we use a tool that we call what do you want, how did we do? And we ask people at the beginning of a project to write down on post-its what they want from us, and they put it up onto a piece of paper and we group them into themes. And then we get them to score against how we're doing on that now. And then we do that again at the end of the event or at the end of the project, if it's weeks later or years later. And that's a tool that we used with our own Happy Museum seminars for about 5 years. So we could really see what people were wanting from us, how that was changing over time, which things we were consistently doing well at, consistently doing poorly at, and which of those changed. So, you know, it's all about creating things that are part of the delivery. Then, of course, there's the life stuff that I told you about. So actually, and we have already got that as an app, so people can on their phone answer those questions. And then I think there's observation, you know, if we want to assess people's well-being when we don't know them yet, sometimes observation can work. So one of my colleagues has worked with a framework that she's created where she's actually judging how people are dressed and behaving physically. So the kids come in with their hoods down and they don't meet your eyes. Actually, after a while, they take their hoods off. After a while, they'll make eye contact. After a while, they might even start to smile and join in. And that systematic observation of that can work really well. So there's a tool that we use called dementia care mapping, which does that with people with dementia who can't answer our questions. But we can really clearly see sometimes a change in their levels of engagement and motivation after they've taken part in a creative project, for example. I think those are the main things that spring to mind.
Okay. No hi ha res més, no hi ha cap
altra... I don't think we have any other questions. Mandy, Gabi, thank you so much for sharing with us your experience and your expertise. Thank you.